At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
When Frederick Banting's phone rang on morning in October 1923, it was a call that every scientist must dream of receiving. On the other end of the line, an excited friend asked Banting if he had seen the morning newspapers. When Banting said no, his friend broke the news himself. Banting had just been awarded the Nobel Prize for his discovery of insulin. Banting told his friend, "Go to hell," and slammed the receiver down. Then he went out and bought a morning newspaper. Sure enough, there in the headlines, he saw in black and white that his worst fears had come true. He had indeed been awarded the Nobel, but so too had his boss, John McLeod, professor of physiology at the University of Toronto. This is a tale of monstrous egos, toxic career rivalries, and injustices. This is the story of insulin. Amazing listeners, welcome to the RX Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Rodin Alekhani, and this episode is being released in July 2025. In each episode of the RX Chronicles podcast, I talk about the story behind the discovery of a pharmaceutical breakthrough and familiarize you with the biography of their founders, from challenges in their life to the pushing force toward their invention and more, to hopefully acknowledge and enlighten their names in the pharmaceutical galaxy. In this episode, I'm going to tell you the story of insulin by tracing its scientific roots, the people who fought to bring it to life, and the legacy it left behind. Before we dive in, I'd like to mention that talking about insulin is not simple at all. Today, there are dozens of insulin formulations on the market, from the rapid-acting and long-acting insulins to insulin analogs and biosimilars, each have their own history, chemistry, and controversy. But in this episode, we're going back to the beginning. This is not a story about modern insulin pens or synthetic analogs. This is the story of the first human insulin ever extracted, a crude but miraculous substance that turned diabetes from a death sentence into a treatable disease. All right, let's buckle up and begin today's story. The RX Chronicles podcast, episode 3, Insulin's Birth, Fred Banting and Charles Best. To uncover the story of insulin, we must go back in time to around the end of the 19th century in a farm near Alliston in Ontario, Canada. On November 14, 1891, Frederick Grant Banting, the fourth and youngest son of William and Margaret, was born. Fred Banting was an average student, described as a hardworking, shy, and serious child by local school teachers. His grades were sufficient to earn admission to the University of Toronto. In 1910, he enrolled in the general arts course at Victoria College with tentative plans to pursue a degree in the Methodist ministry. This plan, perhaps more a reflection of his parents' desires than his own, did not materialize, and Banting left Victoria College before completing his first year. In the fall of 1912, Banting re-entered the University of Toronto, this time enrolling in the Faculty of Medicine with a specialty in surgery. Upon declaration of war on August 4, 1914, Banting attempted to enlist in the Canadian Army the following day. Citing his poor eyesight, the Army rejected him. He later joined the Canadian Army Medical Service after earning high grades and completing most of his medical training. He enlisted as a private in the spring of 1915 and before the fall of that year held the rank of surgeon. The University of Toronto Faculty of Medicine, also eager to join the war effort, designed a special curriculum for the class of 1917, considering the fifth year into a special summer and fall semester. Along with most of the other young men in his class, Banting graduated with a bachelor's degree in medicine on December 9, 1916. He reported for active service the following morning. Banting first served at Granville Hospital in England before being sent to the front line as a battalion medical officer in June 1918. In late September of that year, Banting was wounded at the Battle of Chambray, where his conduct during the assault earned him the Military Cross. His wound, though not serious, was slow to heal, keeping Banting in hospital for almost 6 months until December of 1918, more than 3 weeks after the war had ended. He resumed his duties as a medical officer, working first in England, and after returning to Canada in the spring of 1919 at the Christie Street Hospital for Veterans in Toronto. Demobilized in the summer of 1919, Banting stayed in Toronto an additional year to complete his internship in surgery at a hospital for sick children. In the summer of 1920, having completed his duties as senior house surgeon and intending to set up his own practice as a physician and surgeon, Banting left Toronto for London, Ontario. By the fall of that year, a dearth of patients and a lack of funds had driven Banting to the University of Western Ontario, where he took a part-time job as demonstrator in a medical school. On the night of October 31, 1920, while taking notes on an article by Moses Barron for an upcoming lecture on the pancreas, Banting conceived the idea that would change not only his life, but the lives of countless others. Banting first approached Dr. Frederick Miller, a medical research scientist at the University of Western Ontario. Miller referred Banting to one of the leading specialists on carbohydrate metabolism, Professor John McLeod, then at the University of Toronto. In early November, Banting went to Toronto to meet Professor McLeod. Although skeptical of Banting's procedure, McLeod arranged for the young surgeon to have laboratory space in the physiology department, dogs, and assistant. After considering his options in London, Banting returned to Toronto in May 1921 for what was scheduled to be 2 months of research at the university and never returned to his London practice. Although he had assisted Miller with laboratory experiments at the University of Western Ontario, Banting had less experience in that setting than the young assistant whom McLeod assigned to him before leaving the city for the summer. That young assistant's name was Charles Best. Charles Herbert Best was born in Pembroke on February 27, 1899. Pembroke is a small town in the state of Maine with a limited economy based mostly on sardine packing. Charles is the son of Lulu Fisher and Herbert Best, a Canadian-born physician from Nova Scotia, which is one of the provinces of Canada. His father, Herbert, was a doctor in West Pembroke, and his mother, Lulu, was a soprano singer, organist, and pianist. Charles grew up in Pembroke before going to Toronto to study medicine in 1915. Charles spent his childhood and received his early education in West Pembroke. By the time Charles had reached the college age and was choosing between such schools as McGill University and the University of Toronto, family connections persuaded him to pursue his studies in Toronto. Family illness had guided Charles's research interests. His aunt, Anna, dying of diabetes, had profound effects on him. It was for this reason and the fact that his father was a physician that he chose to study at the University of Toronto and train to become a doctor. After graduating from high school in 1915, Charles moved to Toronto, briefly attending Harvard Collegiate and then commencing his bachelor's at University College in the University of Toronto, where he was president of his first year. In 1918, he enlisted in the Canadian Army, serving at Petawawa, Ontario, with the 70th Battery of the Horse Artillery, becoming a surgeon, and then overseas in Wales with the 2nd Canadian Tank Battalion. He returned to Toronto in 1919 to complete his undergraduate degree in the Physiology and Biochemistry course. In July 1920, Charles became engaged to Margaret Hooper Mahan at the farm of his friend and classmate Clark Noble. The two friends worked as research assistants under the supervision of Professor John McLeod. In the spring of 1921, Charles and Clark graduated from the Physiology and Biochemistry course. Both men were to start the master's program at the University of Toronto the following year. McLeod offered Charles and Clark the opportunity to spend part of their summer working with Fred Banting, assisting him with experiments on depancreatized dogs. Charles and Clark allegedly tossed the coin to determine who would start first. Charles won and promptly began work with Banting. Clark Noble was to have replaced Charles Best in July, but sometime before then, he and Best agreed that Best, who had become surgically proficient at the required operations, would stay on until the end of that summer. Discoveries made in the lab during the critical summer of 1921 determined the future course of Charles Best's career. Before diving into the events that led to the discovery of insulin, we need to take a brief step back. The discovery of insulin didn't happen in isolation. It was built on decades of physiological research that slowly pieced together the relationship between the pancreas and diabetes. So, before we meet Banting and Best, let's quickly review the key discoveries that set the stage. The connection between pancreatic secretions and diabetes was first shown in 1889 by two German physiologists at the University of Strasbourg, Oskar Minkowski and Joseph von Mehring. While investigating the effect of pancreatic secretions on the metabolism of fat, they performed a complete pancreatectomy, or complete surgical removal of the pancreas, on a laboratory dog, only to discover
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. You coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
That the animal developed the disease indistinguishable from diabetes. 20 years earlier, a German medical student, Paul Langerhans, had discovered two systems of cells in the pancreas. The acini, which he knew produced the pancreatic digestive secretions, and another system whose function was unknown to him. These cells looked to Langerhans like tiny clusters of cells or islands floating among the acini. In 1901, Eugene Opie, an American pathologist at Johns Hopkins University, made the association between the degeneration of these cells, which had been named the islets of Langerhans, and the onset of diabetes. Through the experimental efforts of these and many other researchers, the stage was set for the discovery of insulin, the hormonal anti-diabetic secretion of the islets of Langerhans, in the first decades of the 20th century. Following the footsteps of earlier researchers, Banting and Best began to study diabetes through an experimental combination of duct ligation, which involved tying off the pancreatic duct to the small intestine, and pancreatectomies. Duct ligation served to atrophy the acini cells that produced the digestive secretions, leaving behind only the cells of the islets of Langerhans. Duct ligated dogs, it was discovered, did not develop diabetes. Pancreatectomy was the method of inducing diabetes. When all pancreatic tissues was removed, the experimental dogs immediately showed signs of glycosuria. Banting's idea of October 30th involved ligation of the pancreatic ducts of a dog and the extraction and isolation of whatever secretions were produced after the atrophy of the acini cells. He and Best began this experiment only to find that it was difficult to keep duct-ligated, depancreatized dogs alive long enough to carry out any tests. After a summer of many setbacks and failures, however, the team reported in the fall that they were keeping a severely diabetic dog alive with injections of an extract made from duct-ligated pancreas and prepared in saline. Amazingly, this extract dramatically lowered the blood sugar levels of diabetic experimental dogs. Best had recently graduated from the physiology and biochemistry course and had done laboratory work as part of his degree. Originally, the experiments were planned to play to Banting and Best's strengths. Banting was to perform the surgery, and Best was to measure the blood and urine sugar levels. Eventually, however, each man became adept to the others as a specialty. Observations and calculations from the experiments were recorded in a series of notebooks by both men. The notebooks also document Banting and Best's many difficulties with their experiments that summer. The two-stage pancreatectomy was a lengthy process, and many dogs died of infection in the summer heat. But their persistence and hard work paid off when on July 30th, Banting and Best injected a diabetic dog with a pancreatic extract that caused a dramatic reduction in blood sugar levels. Both men enthusiastically described their accomplishment in letters to McLeod and then spent the month of August continuing their experiments. McLeod returned from his summer in Scotland, cautious about Banting and Best's success, but agreed that the experiments should be continued. Although Banting, as a research assistant in the physiology department for the summer, had been compensated for the work that he did that summer, Banting's position was not extended into the academic year. As a result, in early September, it appeared that Banting would have no job in Toronto that fall, and that any further work he would do on the experiments would be unpaid. In September, Valian Henderson, head of the pharmacology department, offered Banting a position as demonstrator in his department, which allowed Banting's work on insulin to continue. McLeod continued to supervise the insulin research, and in November, suggested that Banting and Best present their preliminary findings to the Physiological Journal Club of the University of Toronto. That fall, Banting and Best drafted their first paper, The Internal Secretion of the Pancreas, and on November 14, presented their conclusions at a meeting of the Journal Club of the Physiological Society of the University of Toronto. Soon after that meeting, Banting and Best began a longevity experiment. The experiment required a continuous supply of insulin, so the two men set about producing a purified extract. In December, McLeod invited a biochemist to join the team to help find a purified extract. This biochemist was James Collett. Collett was a biochemist in the Department of Physiology at the University of Toronto to help Banting and Best with purifying their extract. Collett, who was also a University of Toronto graduate himself, was on sabbatical from the University of Alberta and, supported by a fellowship, had returned to his alma mater. As the experimental pace quickened, Banting and Best needed large amounts of their extract, and Collett set to work purifying the extract for clinical testing in humans. By Christmas of that year, McLeod had sufficient confidence in the work that he suggested the Toronto team present their findings at the annual meeting of the American Physiological Society at the University of Yale in New Haven, Connecticut. On December 30th, Banting delivered his first public lecture entitled The Beneficial Influences of Certain Pancreatic Extracts on Pancreatic Diabetes. Many prominent scientists and doctors, including two senior diabetes specialists, Dr. Elliot Jocelyn and Dr. Frederick Allen, and George Klaus, Director of Research for Eli Lilly and Company, were in attendance, and the Toronto team filed many questions about their findings. Just to quickly familiarize you with these names, Elliot Jocelyn was the first medical doctor in the United States to specialize in diabetes. Frederick Allen was an American physician who is best remembered for his carbohydrate-restricted low-calorie diet for patients with diabetes. He is known for developing the starvation diet as a treatment which provided mainly fat and protein. And George Klaus is best remembered for his crucial role in bringing insulin to millions of diabetics worldwide. After hearing Banting present his research on insulin, Dr. Klaus became an enthusiastic supporter, and in 1922, Eli Lilly negotiated an agreement with the University of Toronto for the rights to mass-produce insulin for the U.S. market. When Banting rose to address the American Physiological Society at the University of Yale that December, the prestige of the audience took its toll on his nerves. His presentation was a disaster. He later wrote, "When I was called upon to present our work, I became almost paralyzed. I could not remember, nor could I think. I had never spoken to an audience of this kind before. I was overawed. I did not present it well." Desperate to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, McLeod stepped in, took over, and finished the presentation. For Banting, this was a brazen coup by McLeod to rob him of the credit for having discovered insulin and to rub salt into the wound. It had been done in front of the most eminent doctors in the field. It confirmed Banting's growing suspicions that insulin was slipping from his grasp, and he desperately needed to reassert his authority over the discovery. After the events at Yale, Best began to develop a method for producing a potent and pure extract that could be safely administered to humans. On January 11, 1922, Best's pancreatic extract was successfully injected to Leonard Thompson, a 14-year-old diabetic at Toronto General Hospital. The extract lowered blood sugar, but had little clinical effect. On the afternoon of January 11, 1922, Thompson was injected with 15 milliliters of pancreatic extract. Hopes were high, but the effect was disappointing. Despite causing a 25% drop in Leonard's blood sugar levels, he continued to produce ketones, a sure sign that the extract had only limited anti-diabetic effect. But much more seriously, the extract had triggered a toxic reaction resulting in the eruption of abscesses at the injection site. Reporting on this work in the Canadian Medical Association journal, Banting and Best drew the dismal conclusion that no clinical benefit was evidenced by the injection of their extract. 2 weeks later, on January 23rd, Thompson was injected once again. And this time, the result was starkly different. When they published their work, the Toronto team recorded that Thompson became brighter, more active, looked better, and said he felt stronger. His blood sugar levels were markedly reduced. But perhaps the most important result of all was that this time, there were no toxic side effects. But what had changed in those 2 weeks? The answer is that this second batch of extract had not been prepared by Banting and Best, but by their colleague, James Collip. If you remember, he was a biochemist by training, and with his expertise, had been able to remove enough of the impurities from the raw pancreatic extract so that when injected, it did not cause a toxic reaction. The secret of Collip's success was alcohol. Banting and Best had themselves used alcohol to clean up their preparations of impurities, but it was Collip who really cracked the method of doing this to make an extract that could be used to successfully treat a patient with no adverse reactions. He had also discovered that although insulin might save lives, it could take them too. For when Collip injected some of his purified preparations into healthy animals, they became convulsive, comatose, and eventually died. This was because Collip's preparations were now so pure that they were plunging the...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Animals into hypoglycemic shock. This is a danger which every type 1 patient is today thought to recognize. And also, again, thanks to Collip's work, how to remedy it with some quick-acting sugar. With this successful extraction experiment, the production phase of the insulin project had begun with the cooperation of the Kanna Antitoxin Laboratories. Banting's involvement in the experimental work is less evident during the winter and spring of 1922. However, he did treat diabetic patients as insulin became more readily available. At the end of January, Collip came to Banting and Best's lab and informed the two that although he had discovered the method to produce pure extract, he would share it only with McLeod. It was only Best's quick restraint that stopped Banting from attacking Collip. When Collip was reluctant to divulge the secrets of his success, Banting's temper boiled over. Banting somewhere said, "I grabbed him in one hand by the overcoat where it met in front, and almost lifting him, I sat him down on the chair. I don't remember all that was said, but I remember telling him that it was a good job he was so much smaller. Otherwise, I would knock hell out of him." February 1922, Caleb proved unable to sustain the purity and potency of the extract he made in January. The resulting insulin famine pressured Best and the insulin team to refine their extraction methodology. At the same time, personal tension was mounting over the four scientists as Banting became increasingly bitter toward McLeod and pitted himself and Best against Caleb in the race to purify the extract. As Banting sank further into a festering stew of fear and suspicion, he began calming his nerves with alcohol stolen from the lab. As he describes, "I don't think that there was one night during the month of March 1922 that I went to bed sober." Sometime in April, with the help of Dr. Joseph Gilchrist and the support of the Department of Soldiers' Civil Reestablishment, Banting reestablished a diabetic clinic at the Christie Street Hospital. Banting also opened his own practice in Toronto, treating private patients, one of whom, Jim Havens of Rochester, New York, became the first American citizen to be injected with insulin. On May 3, 1922, McLeod, representing the group, announced to the international medical community at a meeting of the Association of American Physicians that they had discovered insulin, the anti-diabetic agent. But what were Banting and Best doing in that time? In May, a stable method was established and the team enlisted the Eli Lilly and Company to collaborate in large-scale production, and Best, at only 23 years of age and having just completed his master's, was put in charge of the production of insulin for Canada. He was also serving as a liaison between the research laboratories of Eli Lilly in Indianapolis and the Connell Laboratories in Toronto. In the summer of 1922, large-scale clinical trials of insulin began at the Toronto General Hospital and the Christie Street Hospital. After an agreement was reached with Eli Lilly to distribute insulin on a larger scale, the research entered the clinical testing phase. Insulin was sent to diabetic clinics in Boston and New Jersey, and in June 1922, the University of Toronto and the Toronto General Hospital established a diabetic clinic, and Banting was appointed as one of the clinic's staff. Case studies of these early trials, including some written by Banting, were published in a special issue of the Journal of Metabolic Research. Meanwhile, Banting began to receive letters from the public requesting insulin treatment. Among the many appeals he received was one from Antoinette Hughes, the wife of the then United States Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes. Mrs. Hughes sought treatment for her 14-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, whom Banting agreed to treat. She arrived in Toronto with her nurse on August 16, 1922, weighing only 45 pounds or 20 kilograms. A prolific letter writer, Elizabeth recorded many observations of her life under Banting's care that summer and fall. She was also one of Banting's greatest successes. 3 months after her arrival in Toronto, Elizabeth had more than doubled her weight and was able to return home.
Thank you.
Best entered medical school at the University of Toronto in the fall of 1922, while still the director of the insulin division of the Connell Laboratories. In May 1923, the Banting and Best Medical Research Act became law by the Ontario Legislative Assembly, and the university established the Banting and Best Chair of Medical Research with Banting as its first director. As news of the discovery continued to spread, public recognition of Banting's achievement arrived in various forms. In July, the Dominion government awarded Banting a lifetime annuity of $7,500. Also in July, and by this time weary of public speaking, Banting was asked to open the Canadian National Exhibition, where he spoke to a crowd of more than 76,000 people. Around the same time, Best was appointed a research associate with a budget of $2,500 for the promotion of medical research under his direction. On October 25, 1923, Banting became the first Canadian to win a Nobel Prize in Medicine, conferred jointly on Banting and MacLeod. When the 1923 Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine was announced, it went only to Banting and MacLeod. Both Best and Collip were excluded by the Stockholm jurors. In the interest of honoring Best's critical role in the experiments that led to insulin's discovery, Banting shared his prize money with him. Interestingly, Best was lecturing to a group of medical students at Harvard University on October 26, 1923, when he received word that Banting and MacLeod were awarded the Nobel Prize. Dr. Elliot Jocelyn, who had invited Best to speak at Harvard, read aloud to Best and his audience the telegram that announced Banting's intention to share his half of the award with Best. MacLeod subsequently shared his winnings with Collip as well. Let's continue with what happened to the rest of the lives of our heroes. After the discovery of insulin, Banting supervised important research on silicosis, but never again had any real success of his own. Although he did complete his MD in 1922, Banting did not pursue any advanced degrees. Public confidence in his scientific abilities nevertheless remained high. In 1930, the University of Toronto dedicated a building to him. In 1938, he was invited to become the first chairman of the Associate Committee on Medical Research of the National Research Council, and newspapers continued to print reports of Banting's new discoveries, promising that he was working on something even better than insulin. Banting's personal life was also a matter of public interest. The media reported his whirlwind romance and marriage to Marion Robertson in 1924, and later, after the marriage ended badly 8 years later, the media's scrutiny was no less detailed. The press followed Banting on a painting expedition to the Arctic in 1927 with A.Y. Jackson, the infamous Canadian painter whom he had met at the Arts and Letters Club in Toronto. In 1934, Banting's name again made headlines. Much to his distaste, Banting had been knighted by King George V. When war broke out again in 1939, Banting, as he had done 25 years earlier, was among the first to offer his services to his country. He rejoined the Royal Canadian Army Medical Corps. As part of his war service, Banting was en route to England the night of February 20, 1941, when his plane, a Lockheed Hudson bomber, crashed on the east coast of Newfoundland. Shortly after takeoff, the plane developed mechanical problems and the pilot attempted to bring the plane down near Musgrave Harbor, but hit a tree on landing. Both the radio operator and the navigator were killed on impact, and Banting was fatally injured and died the next day. Banting left one son, William, and his second wife, Lady Henrietta Ball Banting. On September 3rd, 1924, Best married Margaret Mahon. In 1925, he graduated from medical school at the top of his class, thereby earning the Ellen Mickle Fellowship. Later that year, the couple set sail for England, where they spent the next 2.5 years while Bess did postgraduate work under the supervision of the head of the National Institute for Medical Research in London. In 1928, Bess was awarded a Doctor of Science from the University of London and returned to Toronto, this time as head of the physiology department, filling the position left vacant by the departure of McLeod. McLeod himself had recommended Bess for the job. At the University of Toronto, Bess continued to research the physiological action of insulin and to direct teams researching the discovery of histaminase and choline. Bess's most acclaimed scientific accomplishment after insulin was a project he began after becoming head of the physiology department. In 1929, Bess assembled a team to research the purification of heparin in the 1930s. Heparin, which is a blood anticoagulant, had been discovered in 1916 at Johns Hopkins University, but remained toxic until Best and his co-workers succeeded in developing a purified heparin extract safe for human use. By 1935, heparin was being tested in surgery at Toronto General Hospital, and by 1940 was available on a large scale. None of the open-heart surgery or organ transplants undertaken today would be possible without heparin. In 1939, Bess joined the war effort, initiating the Canadian Blood Serum Project, which produced dried human serum for military use. This project involved the collaboration of Bess, his staff, the Kana Antitoxin Laboratories, the Canadian Red Cross, and the financial support of the Canadian government. Bess's war work increased in the 1940s when, following Banting's death in 1941, Bess assumed the position of director of the Banting and Bess Department of Medical Research. He channeled that department's resources towards research for the Royal Canadian Navy. In 1942, he was appointed director of the Medical Research Unit of the Royal Canadian Navy with the rank of surgeon and lieutenant commander. In this capacity, he began studies on night vision, motion sickness, nutrition, and other conditions affecting naval personnel at sea. Bess was promoted to surgeon captain in 1943. After the war, Bess turned his attention back to diabetes. He led a research team seeking a method to stimulate the islets of Langerhans to produce insulin in diabetic patients, as well as organizing lay support groups and educational programs for diabetics. In 1940, Banting and Bess were made honorary presidents of the newly formed American Diabetes Association. Bess was also honorary president of the International Diabetes Federation and of the Canadian Diabetes Association. In the 1950s, in recognition of Bess's contribution to Canadian scientific research, the University of Toronto drew up plans to construct the Charles Best Institute. The building, erected beside the Banting Institute, opened in 1953. Throughout the 1950s, Bess's textbooks, The Human Body and Its Functions, The Physiological Basis of Medical Practice, and The Living Body continued to be widely used and reprinted. After a severe illness, Bess retired from his university positions in 1965. In 1971 and 72, he and his wife participated in worldwide events celebrating the 50th anniversary of the discovery of insulin, giving lectures and attending festivities in North and South America, Europe, and the Middle East. It's also noteworthy that on the 50th anniversary of the discovery of insulin in 1971, Bess was made a Companion of Honor by Queen Elizabeth II. Bess also received many honorary degrees from universities around the world. He died at Toronto General Hospital in 1978 at the age of 79, and only 1 week after hearing the news that his eldest son had succumbed to a heart attack. Before finishing the story of insulin, I think I should also commemorate two names who came painfully close to this discovery, like Georg Sulzer and Nicola Paolesco, whose early experiments brought science to the edge of insulin's breakthrough, but who history would ultimately leave in the shadows. In 1908, over 20 years before the Canadians, German doctor Georg Sulzer had shown that pancreatic extracts could not only reduce the sugars and ketones in the urine of 6 diabetic patients, but also bring at least one of those patients out of a diabetic coma. Calling his preparation a comatol, Sulzer had been so confident about its effectiveness in treating diabetes that he had even filed a patent on it. Like Banting and Best, he had also faced problems with side effects. Impurities in the preparation had caused fever, shivering, and vomiting in patients, and Sulzer knew that this would have to be overcome if acomatol was ever to be used clinically. But he also knew how to do this, because in his patent, he had explained how alcohol could be used to remove these impurities. By 1914, things were looking hopeful. Sulzer now had the support of Swiss pharmaceutical Hoffmann La Roche, and best of all, his preparations were causing no signs of fever, shivering, or vomiting. But now, Sulzer observed some new and more serious side effects. Test animals became convulsive and sometimes slipped into a coma. And before Sulzer even had the chance to work out what was going on, disaster struck. With the outbreak of World War I in the summer of 1914, Sulzer's research on insulin was brought to an abrupt halt from which it never recovered. Then, nearly a decade later, came the news that the Nobel Prize had gone to Banting and MacLeod. This was a severe blow, and it was quickly followed by another. Only now did Sulzer realize that the side effects of convulsion and coma were not due to impurities, but rather the symptoms of hypoglycemic shock arising from a preparation of insulin that was so pure it was causing a catastrophic crash in blood sugar levels. He had a potent preparation of insulin in his hands, only to have it snatched from his grasp by circumstances well beyond his control. Revealed that during the summer of 1921, just as Banting and Best were embarking on their own research, a Romanian scientist called Nicola Paolesco had already published similar experiments in a European scientific journal. But Paolesco's scientific work has since been overshadowed by the ugly revelation of his anti-Semitic politics and the role that he played in inciting the Holocaust in Romania. When Best was himself asked whether researchers such as Paolesco, Sulzer, and a handful of others such as the Rockefeller scientist Israel Kleiner deserved any credit for the discovery of insulin, his reply spoke volumes. He said, "None of them convinced the world of what they had. This is the most important thing in any discovery. You've got to convince the scientific world, and we did." The discovery of insulin wasn't a clean and orderly process. It was messy, emotional, full of missteps, rivalries, and ethical gray zones. Credit was contested. Partnerships fractured. Promising leads were nearly forgotten. And yet, out of all that chaos, out of ambition, desperation, and a bit of luck, came one of the most important medical breakthroughs in human history. Insulin didn't just save lives. It changed the way we understand disease, the way we approach discovery, and the way we define scientific legacy. It's a story of success, but also of the many who almost got there, the ones left out, and the complicated human path behind every miracle. That's all I had to cover for you in this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. The Rx Chronicles podcast is produced and hosted by me, Radin Alekhani. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to my channel on your preferred podcast platform, like the episodes, and leave a comment for me. This is the biggest support that I can get from you all. With that, stay tuned for the next episode very soon. Until then.
Truth unfolds, bottles cracked, the lies retold. Underneath the fluorescent glare, hope and guilt hang in the air. Desperation claws at my mind, these formulas, a twisted grind. But now I stand in a haze of discovery, search for the light in a world of recovery. No more silence, circadian endless fight, the chaos at night. I find my sight, my sight. They mix dangers instead of cure, profit margins who can be pure. Justice lost in the shadows deep, promises broken, the secrets keep. Altered dreams in a stalemate space. I'm seeking truth, not a saving faith. But now more silence, suffocating in this fight. In the chaos of the night, I'll find my sight.